So this is the place. Everybody knows what I'm going to say next, right? Turn with me, if you will. And in this case, it's to the book of Numbers, or Bamidbar in the wilderness, chapter 8. And the Torah portion starts, right there where it says, "And Yahuwah spoke unto Moshe," and here's what he said. So the words in red are coming in quotes, and then it says, "Speak unto Aaron." So this is something directed to Aaron, and Moshe is told, "Say unto him, when you light the lamps," or when you mount the lamps is another way to render it, but the Hebrew word there is beha aloteka, and literally that's when you light the lamps. Those seven lamps that give light in front of the menorah. And here are the instructions. Aaron did so. He lit the lamps so as to give light in front of the menorah as Yahuwah commanded Moshe. Now here's another one of those Rashi comments, and simply because it's important. I always like to emphasize what look like little trivial things like this. He's commanded and he did so. You know, we nowadays tend to think, well, big deal. And the answer is, yeah, it's a big deal because Scripture tells us this. And the Rashi-ism basically is that he did exactly as he was commanded without deviation. In other words, he did it exactly the way he had been told to do it, which is cool. But most importantly, it's just simply that there is no idle repetition in Scripture. He was commanded and he did. And I guess I'll put it this way. May that be said of each of us. All right, this then was the work of the menorah. Now, a lot of times the English translates it as the candlestick. I don't care for that. The menorah is the menorah. So here it is, the menorah, a beaten work of gold. Now, the understanding is this was not only a beaten work of gold, it was one piece of gold that was the entire seven-branch menorah was beaten out of. On the base flowers thereof, it was a beaten work, according to the pattern which Yahuwah had shown to Moshe, and so he thus made the menorah. And then Yahuwah spoke to Moshe some more and said, "Take the Levites from among the B'nai Israel and clean them up. Here's what you're going to do." And he describes the process. Cleanse them. Sprinkle water purification upon them, which would involve the water of the red heifer. Let them to have a razor pass over all their flesh. And this, the sages note, is reminiscent of what was done with the Metzorah. And there's even an implication, maybe this is like a spiritual replacement for that. But in any case, they're going to get cleaned up good, and at this point they're shaven clean. And let them wash themselves and wash their clothes and cleanse themselves. And then we're going to take a young bull and its meal offering, fine flour and oil, and another young bull for a chatat, a sin offering. Present the Levites before the tent of meeting and assemble kol edat, the entirety of the congregation of B'nai Israel, the children of Israel, out there. And then it says, you present the Levites before Yahuwah, and the children of Israel shall lay their hands upon the Levites. All right, now pause here, because this is quite an assembly. There are, minimum 600,000 or so men able to go to war. You add the rest of the B'nai Israel in there, we're talking 2 or 3 million folks. So this is a huge assembly. And furthermore, there's something like 22,000 Levites of all of these various tribes. So this is a big group. They're going to lay hands on them. Well, here's the question. Obviously, even if it's 22,000 folks in the midst of tens of thousands, not everybody can get their hand on a Levite. And when you try to picture this, it's downright amazing. Now, there is another teaching that I think is interesting. I'm not sure that it follows, to my mind, from the translation here in the Hebrew or the English, but it says, before the children of Israel. And then they'll lay their hands upon the Levites. There are some of the translators that try to claim that, you know, this really doesn't include the word, but it should, the firstborn. Now, why would they say that? Well, because approximately, if you remember, there were just a few more firstborn than there were Levites. Or the other way around, actually. We'll get to that in just a second here. But approximately 22,000 Levites, approximately 22,000 firstborn. So that's a lot closer to a one-to-one ratio at any rate. It makes a certain amount of sense, but that's not what I see in the text. So that's all I'll say there. But in any case, Aaron shall offer the Levites before Yahuwah for a wave offering from the children of Israel. They may be able to do the service, the avodah of Yahuwah. And the Levites are then going to lay their hands upon the bullocks and offer the one for a sin offering, a chatat, and the other for a burnt offering, or lifted up, olah, unto Yahuwah to make atonement for the Levites. And then you set the Levites before Aaron, before his sons, and offer them for a wave offering unto Yahuwah. And this is what is done so that you separate the Levites from among the B'nai Israel. And the Levites, remember, they're replacing the firstborn. They are mine, he says. And after that, the Levites go in to do the service of the tent of meeting. And you cleanse them and offer them for a wave offering. Now, here is where I'll pause again. There's an interesting bit of Midrash on this one as well. A wave offering. Well, what's a wave offering? Okay, normally you think about the priest taking a sheaf of barley or something, holding it up, waving it around. Maybe he executes some kind of a pattern with it, up, down, sideways. But in any case, he lifts it up and he waves it around. Does he do that with the Levites? And at least a lot of the sages claim, yeah, that's what he did. He lifted up all of the Levites. Say, what? 22,000 of them? Well, there are those that will make the claim. And I'm thinking, man, that's one tired and sore puppy when he's done at the end of the day, unless there's some miraculous healing going on. Maybe he lifts up a few of them and others levitate. I don't know. But in any case, any way you slice it, this is quite a ceremony and quite an operation that's going on. And as to exactly how it plays out, I guess I'd say the wave offering makes sense. You know, come to think of it, I mentioned this. Well, I didn't mention it, but I had the thought as I was reading through some of this the other day. Nowadays, we'd say, oh, the wave offering is, you know, you get them all lined up in kind of a stadium formation and says, do the wave! And the Levites all do the wave, right? No, maybe not. Somehow, I don't picture that quite either. But the key is the following. Verse 16 says, for they are wholly given unto me from among the B'nai Israel. And this is that word there that means in place of. Tachat. In place of, or instead of, those that open the womb, the firstborn of the children of Israel. I have taken them in place of those. Now, from among all the firstborn among the children of Israel, those are mine. He says that by right, both of man and of beast. And on the day that I smote the firstborn in the land of Mitzrayim, Egypt, I sanctified them, I set them apart to myself. And now I've taken all the Levites instead of, tachat, the firstborn among the children of Israel. And I've given the Levites, they're given to Aaron. So he takes them, they're his, he then gives them to Aaron and to his sons thereafter from among the B'nai Israel to do the service, the avodah, of the B'nai Israel in the tent of meeting and to make atonement for the children of Israel so that there's no plague that comes among them through the children of Israel coming nigh unto the sanctuary, to the Mishkan. So thus, of course, as commanded, did Moshe and Aaron and all of the congregation of the B'nai Israel and unto the Levites, they did this. According to all that Yahuwah had commanded Moshe touching the Levites, so, in fact, that is what the B'nai Israel did. The Levites purified themselves, washed their clothes. Aaron offered them for a sacred gift before Yahuwah, and he made atonement for them to cleanse them. And after that, the Levites went in to do their service in the tent of meeting before Aaron and before his sons, just as, here it is again, Yahuwah had commanded Moshe concerning the Levites. Well, that is exactly what they did. And then Yahuwah wasn't done yet. He spoke to Moshe and he said the following. This is that which pertains unto the Levites. So here's a little bit more detail. From age 25 and up, they will go in to perform the service, whatever it is that they're by family assignments are in the tent of meeting. And from the age of 50 years, they return from that service of the work, and they're basically retired at that point. But they minister with their brethren in the tent of meeting to keep the charge. They don't do other manners of service. Thus shall they do, and you do, basically, is the commandment here, unto the Levites as opposed to or in the way that all of this touches their charges. So here is the additional information. They serve from 25 to 50, at which point they semi-retire, at least. They don't do that kind of service anymore, but they're still in a ministerial capacity. Okay, chapter 9 is going to talk about the Pesach service in the wilderness. Now, a lot of folks teach, and it's, I would say, not 100% obvious from Scripture, but certainly this claim is, well, is consistent with what we see, that this is the only This and the one that we're going to get in just a minute here associated with it a month late. The only real Pesach service in the wilderness for 40 years. Do we know that for 100% sure? Again, no. But it certainly is the only one that's described this way. And there are some other indications that maybe that really is the case. So it says, Yahuwah spoke to Moshe in the wilderness, Bamidbar, Sinai, in the first month of the second year. Now, after they have come out of Mitzrayim. And he said the following, let the B'nai Israel keep the Pesach in its appointed season. In this 14th day of this month at dusk, you keep it in its appointed season. Do everything according to the statutes that I've already communicated to you and according to all the ordinances of this same thing. That's what you're going to do. So Moshe spoke to the children of Israel, tell them they should keep the Passover, the Pesach, and they did. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month at dusk, Bamidbar Sinai, in the wilderness there, according to all that Yahuwah had commanded, so they did. But there were certain men who were unclean by the dead body of a man. Now, tradition at least says, and here's one of those places where you say, well, the tradition is consistent with Scripture. There may be other of those men who had similar issues. But remember, they brought the bones of Joseph up out of Mitzrayim too. And so one of the claims is that there were the men who were basically dealing with the body of Joseph, and they were unclean, and that's what this is talking about. Well, whether that's exactly true or not, no doubt there were other men that had, in a group of multiple millions, been associated one way or the other with the body that was dead, so they couldn't keep the Pesach. So they come to Moshe and before Aaron, and they ask him, hey, we're unclean by this dead body, so how are we going to be, what's going to happen? Are we going to be kept back? So we can't bring the offering of Yahuwah in its appointed season among the children of Israel. That's a problem. They wanted to do this. So Moshe said to them, hey, hang out here. Stay around so that I can hear what Yahuwah will command concerning you. And he got an answer. The answer was, speak unto the children of Israel. Tell them the following. If any man of you of your generation, so this is going to apply thereafter as well, is unclean by reason of a dead body, or for that matter, if you're in a journey afar off, but he still would like to keep the Passover unto Yahuwah, and he ought to, of course, in the second month on the 14th day. So 1 month after the regular one, we got the makeup Passover. Then they shall keep it. They eat it with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs. These commandments are going to sound real familiar. Leave none of it until morning. Don't break a bone. According to the statute of the Pesach, in other words, everything like for the rest of the time, that's what they do. But if the man is clean and he's not on a journey, in other words, he doesn't qualify for this makeup Passover, that soul is to be cut off from his people if he fails to do this, to bring the offering of Yahuwah in its appointed season. He bears his own sin. And cut off is another one of those words. I have heard people say that means he dies. I don't personally believe that, because if that was the case, he would say so. But it does seem to mean that he is separated in, at the very least, a spiritual sense, perhaps in a physical sense, and may, and this is kind of the general understanding, may end up dying a bit earlier than he otherwise would have. But how are you going to know? And if there's a stranger who is sojourning among you, and he would like to keep the Pesach, according to the statute and the ordinance thereof, he shall do it. You are to have one statute, both for the stranger and for him that is born in the land. And on the day that the Mishkan, the tabernacle, was reared up, that cloud covered it, even the tent of the testimony. And at evening, there was upon the tabernacle, it were, the appearance of fire, and the fire lasted until morning. So it was always. The cloud covered it by day and the appearance of fire by night. Whenever the cloud was taken up from over the Mishkan, the Ohel, the tent, then after that the children of Israel journeyed. And the place where it stopped and abode, that's where they encamped. And at the commandment of Yahuwah, the children of Israel journeys, and at the commandment of Yahuwah, they encamped. As long as the cloud stayed there upon the tabernacle, they remained encamped. Sometimes it was many days, and they didn't journey, and other times it was just a few days. According to the commandment of Yahuwah, they remained in camp. And according to the commandment of Yahuwah, they journeyed. You get the impression here. It's redundant. At least it sounds redundant, isn't it? It's up to him. And it's up to the cloud. And that determines precisely where they go, when they go, and how long they stay. Sometimes the cloud was there from evening until morning. When the cloud was taken up in the morning, they journeyed. or if it continued by day and by night when it was taken up, they journeyed. So again, do you get the idea? Whether it's 2 days or a month or a year, when the cloud tarried upon the Mishkan, the tabernacle, the children of Israel remained. And they did not journey, but when it left, they went with it. And at the commandment of Yahuwah, they encamped, and at the commandment of Yahuwah, they journeyed. They kept the charge of Yahuwah at the commandment of Yahuwah by the hand of Moshe. There is a consistent theme that runs through here. It's all got to do with obedience. He says, go, they go. He says, don't go, and they stay. And it's all about the commandments that were given to Moshe. And in most cases, we're going to see a problem here coming up. But as a general rule, when he gave the commandments as commanded, so did they. Chapter 10 is Yahuwah speaking to Moshe, going to talk about making some trumpets out of silver, out of kesef. Beaten work, you make them. They're for calling the congregation and for causing the camps to set out. So basically, they know that when the cloud is taken up, it's time to go. But there is a question of, let's keep this thing organized. And imagine, with multiple millions of people, that's a big deal. So when they blow with them, plural, both of them, in other words, Kol Edot, all the congregation shall gather themselves unto you at the door of the tent of meeting. But if they blow with just one of the two silver trumpets, then it's the leaders, the princes, the heads of the thousands that gather themselves unto you. When they blow an alarm, now alarm is this word, teruah. The camps that lie on the east side shall take the journey. And then when they blow the alarm the second time, the camps on the south side. So it's basically going to go clockwise, the way we're used to looking at the east, south, west, and north. The south camp set up next, then they blow an alarm. And when the assembly is to be gathered together, you blow, but shall not sound the alarm, the teruah. And the sons of Aaron, the priests, shall blow at the trumpets. This shall be a statute forever to you throughout your generations. When you go to war against the adversary that opposes you in the land, then you sound the alarm with the trumpets, and you'll be remembered before Yahuwah your El, and you, so shall I be saved from my enemies, right? Remember the song? And that's what will happen. Also, in the day of your gladness, your appointed seasons, your new moons, you blow with these trumpets over your burnt offerings and over the sacrifices of your shalamim, your peace offerings, and this shall be a memorial before your El. And then he signs it this time, Ani Yahuwah Elohim. So it came to pass in the second year, second month, 20th day of the month. Let's see here. Think about that. Second year, second month, 20th day. So this would be after the makeup Passover and the week following. So he gives them time to get all that done. And at the 20th day, the cloud was taken up. So it's time to move on. And the children of Israel set forward by their stages out of the wilderness of Sinai. The cloud abode in the wilderness of Paran. They took their first journey according to the commandment of Yahuwah by the hand of Moshe. And in the first place, the standard of the camp of the children of Judah set forward according to their host. And we're going to get now the listing of the tribes in order. Remember, four sets of three. And again, it's going to tell us the leader of the host was Nachshon, son of Amminadab. Over the host of the tribe of Issachar, that would be the second in the set that goes with Judah, Nathaniel, son of Zuar, and then we get to Zebulon, Eliab, son of Helon there. Tabernacle was taken down. The sons of Gershon and the sons of Merari, who bore the tabernacle, set forward. And then we have the standard of the camp of Reuben. He goes according to his host. Here we have Elizur, son of Shedeur. And then the next one, Simeon, represented by Shalumiel, son of Zerudashai, over the host of the tribe of the children of Gad, Elisaph, son of Duel. And then the Kohathites, the bearers of the sanctuary, set forward so that when they got there, they can rear the Mishkan back up again. Standard of the camp of Ephraim set forward. Elishama, son of Amihud, was the leader there over the host of the tribe of the children of Manasseh. So we got Ephraim and Manasseh in that group. Then Benjamin. And then we get to the children of Dan. That would be the first of the final set, the rearward of all the camps, set forward according to their host. The leader there, Ahiezer, son of Amidashai, and over the host of the tribe of Asher, the next in that group, Pagiel, and finally Naphtali, bringing up the rear, Ahira, son of Enan. Thus, it says, were the journeyings of the children of Israel according to their hosts, and they set forward. So here we have an understanding of how it is that they're going to go, what the order looks like. And one more interesting, I guess you'd say, part of the story. Now, this is something that we kind of sort of have heard about before. And admittedly, every time I read this, there is some ambiguity here. Let me read it in the English, see if it makes sense, and how you would understand it. Moshe says to some fellow named Hobab, son of Reuel the Midianite. Moses' father-in-law, it says. Wait a minute. This guy has more names, honestly, than anyone else in Scripture, as far as I can tell. He has several names, but Reuel is certainly one of them. Another one, of course, is Yitro, or Jethro. Now, the question is, who is Hobab? Some say Hobab is another name for Reuel, a.k.a. Yitro. Honestly, I read it, and I'm not quite so sure, because the other way to read this is that Hobab, the son of Reuel the Midianite, Moshe's father-in-law, would be Moshe's brother-in-law, right? If he's the son of Reuel the Midianite, and that actually makes more sense, so that's the reading I would generally go with, even though there's no degree of unanimity that some say, no, maybe Hobab really is Yitro. But one thing is for sure, Hobab is a relative by marriage. He probably is the brother-in-law, I'm guessing. But the story sounds like what we've already heard about Yitro. Remember, he was going to go back home, and this is about the right time. So Moshe tells whoever this guy is, whether it's his father-in-law or his brother-in-law, we are journeying unto the place which Yahuwah said, I'll give you, and come on with us, and it'll do you some good. You'll do good with us, and we will do good with you, and Yahuwah has spoken good concerning Israel. Well, says whoever this guy is, brother-in-law or father-in-law, I won't go, but I need to depart to my own land and to my own kin. Oh, please, don't leave us, because you know how we're to encamp in the wilderness, and you'll be literally like kind of an additional set of eyes for us. And if it will be, if you will go with us, yea, that whatsoever good Yahuwah does to us, well, he'll do that unto you as well. Sounds like a good plan. Now, notice, doesn't actually tell us. We know that Reuel, a.k.a. Yitro, didn't go. But as to Hobab, at least at this point, that ambiguity remains. All right, they set forward from there 3 days' journey. The Ark of the Covenant of Yahuwah went before them to seek out a resting place, and the cloud of Yahuwah was over them by day when they set forward from the camp. And then, oh, wait a second. Here's one of those interesting things. Now, this one is also interesting because in the English Bible, you don't see it. But it's there big as life in the Hebrew. Okay, there is a set of what are called inverted noons. You know what a noon looks like? It looks like a right-hand bracket most of the time in the English. So that's a regular noon. You invert it, now it looks like a left-hand bracket. Sometimes it's drawn a little bit bigger, or the scribes put it in a little bit bigger. But there is a set-apart section in here, the last three verses of chapter 10. And as you know, any time when you see these scribal notations, they're also called the jots and tittles of Scripture. They're the thing that Yeshua said in Matthew 5. He wasn't going to change, not the tiniest part, not even these, even though they don't even get translated into English. So whatever they are, they stayed. And whatever they do here, well, they seem to set apart these last couple of verses. You'll hear all kinds of interesting understandings of what this might mean, the inverted noons. Most popular one is, they call this the book that was never written. Or the literally one little two-verse thing that's kind of an entire book unto itself. Huh. Sounds important anyway. And when you see something like this, you say, well, there really is something key here that is being set apart, that is being emphasized. So here it is. And it came to pass, Now, a lot of us are going to go, oh, I know these. I've heard this before. Whenever the ark set forward, that Moshe said the following, arise, O Yahuwah, and let your enemies be scattered. Let those who hate you flee from before you. Right? We all know that one. And then when it rested, he says, return, O Yahuwah, unto the tens of thousands of the families of Yahuwah. Now, here is where I say, this is kind of cool. We've heard this, and if there is a set of inverted noons and a book never written, I have to ask. I'm going to just ask this as a question. Is it possible that since we don't have the ark anymore, and that you could argue that it in a way has set forward, and in a way a whole lot of other things have happened, it's almost like we've got an inverted noon that has opened a set of brackets, and we're still waiting to see how it all plays out, right? In other words, I'm going to suggest somehow or other it's helpful to us to think about being right here in the middle of this book never yet written. We've heard the part where it says, arise, O Yahuwah, and let your enemies be scattered. Let those that hate you flee from before you. And may that be so, and may we remember that. And may there come a time then when it rests and we enter into the rest and we hear, return, O Yahuwah, unto the tens of thousands of the families of Israel. I think that is, a really, really interesting thing to think about, to pray about, if nothing else. Now, we got just a couple more chapters in the Torah portion. Here, surprisingly, perhaps, I guess disappointingly in a way, right after that, we get another section that refers to what I'm going to refer to. I've called it this over and over again, the whiners, the complainers. The murmurers is how it's often rendered in the English. The people, it says, were as murmurers, whiners, mourners even, speaking evil in the ears of Yahuwah. When he heard it, his anger was kindled. He didn't like this murmuring, this whining, this complaining. And the fire of Yahuwah burnt among them and devoured the outermost part of the camp. He fried some. People cried out unto Moshe. Moshe prayed unto Yahuwah, and the fire abated. The name of that place they called Taberah, because of the fire of Yahuwah that burnt among them. Well then, as if that wasn't enough, the mixed multitude that was among them fell a-lusting. The children of Israel also wept on their part and said, Whoa, wish we had some flesh to eat. Now pause. As it turns out, they do. They got a lot of animals with them. Maybe they don't want to eat the animals. Maybe some are thinking, no, it's not the place where Yahuwah has said his name yet. Not time. Save him. Maybe they're just thinking, well, we want to save these so we got breeding stock when we get to the land. For whatever reason, they're wanting additional flesh to eat. Oh, wish we had that. And then they go on to whine, and this is one of my favorite whines, as whines go. We remember the fish that we had in Egypt for nothing. The cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. All of that good stuff. We sure liked being slaves a lot better than here. Why? Because now our soul, our nefesh, has just dried up. Nothing to it at all. We got nothing but this lousy manna to look at and to think about. Say what? This is literally food from heaven, if you think about it, and they're complaining. Now, they've only been there at most for a couple of years at this point. They got they don't know it yet, but they got decades to go. The manna, it says, now this is a kind of an aside, as if the Creator and His Word is explaining to us, look, they shouldn't have been complaining. This is pretty good stuff. The manna was like coriander seed, the appearance thereof like bdellium. And the people went out and they gathered it. They did all kinds of things to it. They ground it in mills. They beat it in mortars. They seethed it in pot. They made cakes out of it. The taste of it was kind of like the taste of a cake baked with oil. Sounds like pretty good stuff. And probably there's a lot you can do with it, as we see. You know, manna cakes, manna fries, manna on a half, whatever. Lots of ways to do things with manna. The dew fell upon the camp in the night. The manna fell upon that. You get the impression here. They should have been happy about this, and they weren't. Now, I guess at this point I'll add one other thing, because whenever you see this kind of stuff, you know there's Midrash, there's commentary, there are traditional teachings. I don't necessarily accept this because we don't have any scriptural basis for it. But I have to admit, this is another one of those that at least kind of, it's funny if nothing else, right? This is a punchline. And it goes like this. The Midrashic claim is that manna tasted really, really good to the people who were grateful for it and kind of bland and nada to the people that weren't. And honestly, I mention that if nothing else because it does kind of resonate, right? If you're looking forward to it, probably tastes pretty good. If you don't think it's anything worth having, well, then it's probably not. So, Moshe, here's all the people weeping, family by family. Now, here is the really sad part of this. It says, every man at the door of his tent. Sounds like this was pretty widespread complaining. This was a democratic form of whining. Every man at the door of his tent. And the anger of Yahuwah was kindled greatly. That's plenty of reason why it would then say Moshe was displeased. He then said unto Yahuwah, come on, why have you dealt ill with your servant? Why have I not found favor in your sight? Maybe the whining is contagious. Moshe is going to do a little bit here too. That you lay this burden of all these people upon me. Have I conceived all this, folks? Hey, these are your people. You brought them out, right? Did I bring them forth that they should say unto me? Or that you, for that matter, should say unto me, carry him in your bosom, as a nursing father carries the sucking child to the land which you swore to their fathers? Wow. Why should I have to give flesh to all of these people? They trouble me with their whining, their weeping, saying, give us flesh that we may eat. I just can't handle it. I cannot bear all of this myself alone. It's just plain too heavy for me, he says. So, look, if this is a way you're going to deal with me, and Moshe puts it like this, kill me, I pray you, out of hand. If I found favor in your sight, then let me not look upon my wretchedness. So, Yahuwah, who was already kind of peeved at the other whiners, didn't seem to go too far overboard here. And he said, look, gather unto me 70 men of the elders of Israel. The men that you know to be the elders of the people, officers over them, bring them unto the tent of meeting that they may stand there with you. I'm going to come down and speak with them there. And I will take of the Spirit which is upon you, and I will put it upon them, and they will help you. They will bear the burden of the people with you, so you don't have to bear it alone. So here is a place where Yahuwah says, look, I understand. Now, this is a pretty heavy burden. He empathizes with Moshe, and he says, okay, I'm going to get 70 folks, 70 elders, and they will help you out. I'll put your spirit upon them. Now, you say to the people, sanctify yourselves against tomorrow. Oh, you asking for flesh? Oh, you're going to get it. You're going to get lots of flesh because you have wept in the ears of Yahuwah saying, oh, I wish we had flesh to eat. It was so great back there in Egypt when we were slaves. So I'm going to give you flesh and you will eat. Oh, believe me, you'll eat. Not just one day. No, not 2 days, not 5 days, not 10, not 20 days. A whole month. Now, I love this. Till it comes out of your nostrils. Until it gets loathsome to you. This is nowadays, this is called aversion therapy. Okay, I suspect that those that make people, you know, want to quit smoking, smoke a whole pack of cigarettes in their mouth at one time, probably read this part and said, you'll avert once it comes out of your nose, right? And that's exactly what's going on here. Why? Because you have rejected Yahuwah who's among you. And you've troubled him with your whining, with your weeping, saying, whoa, why now? Why didn't we come even up out of Egypt? So Moshe said, the people among whom I am are 600,000 men on foot. Now, this is interesting, too. Back to Moshe, okay, he's going to have some help. He's got the 70 elders going to help him out. And yet, poor Moshe here, he's still thinking about the logistics of feeding 600,000 men and a couple million women and children on top of that. 600,000 men on foot, says Moshe, and yet you said, I'm going to give them flesh, and they're going to eat, no, not for just a day, that's a whole month. Now, he's probably doing the math and thinking, how many tons of meat is, that's a lot of meat. Answer, not to worry. He does so. Say this, if flocks and herds were slain for them, would that suffice? If all the fish of the sea were gathered, would that be enough? Yahuwah then says to him, look, okay, and I'm going to paraphrase this a little bit. Come on. You know who you're dealing with here? You don't think I can handle this little problem? Is the hand of Yahuwah waxed short? You just sit back and see whether or not my word shall come to pass. Okay.
So Moshe went out. He told the people what Yahuwah had said. He gathered the 70 men from the elders of the people. He set them round about the ohel, the tent. And Yahuwah came down in the cloud, spoke to him, and took the spirit that was upon him, Moshe, and he put it upon those 70 elders. Came to pass that whenever the spirit rested upon them, they prophesied, but they did so no more. So only at that point did they prophesy. Now, if you do the math here, this is always kind of interesting. We got a total of 70 men that are selected. But wait, there's 12 tribes. Okay, the math would say you got 6 men from each tribe. That would be one nice, easy way to do it. That's 72. So we got 2 guys left over. Poor fellas aren't going to get to have a portion of Moshe's spirit. What they are going to get, though, is mentioned by name in Scripture for all eternity. So there remain 2 men left over. 70 plus 2. The 2 that didn't get picked. Eldad, and the name of the other, Medad. And the Spirit rested upon them. They were of them that were recorded, but had not gone out under the tent. And what did they get instead? They went out and they prophesied. So they're prophesying a whole lot. There ran a young man, told Moshe, Eldad and Medad are out prophesying. They're prophesying in the camp. Almost like a tattletale. Well, you know, is this a problem? Joshua, son of Nun, minister of Moshe from his youth, says, My lord, Moshe, shut him in. Basically, shut him up. This is a problem. We got these 2 guys out prophesying. Moshe says, come on. Are you jealous for my sake? I would that all of the people of Yahuwah were prophets, and he would put his spirit upon them. What are you complaining about? This is good news. Let him go. So Moshe withdrew into the camp, he and the elders of Israel, and there went forth a wind from Yahuwah, and it brought a lot of quails, a whole lot of quails from the sea, and let them fall by the camp. Now, some of the Midrash refers to these as infected quails. These are migrant quails. These are quails coming in bearing not gifts, but some disease or something. There's a whole lot of meat here, but there's going to be a problem as we see. Okay, so the quails come in. Roadkill. Yeah, no, they're not quite roadkill, but they're going to, I guess you could say they're roadkill. They're going to die of their own. Anyway, so they fall, literally, a day's journey on a side and a day's journey on the other side. Now, how far can a guy walk in a day? Typically we used to use a number like 15 or 20 miles. I've hiked 20 miles in a day. That's a good day's hike. This is a 20 by 20 mile square area full of quails in heaps, 2 cubits. That's 3-foot deep quail. 20 miles, that's a lot of quail. Wow. Now, admittedly, if you're walking more than knee-deep in quail, maybe you can't walk nearly as far as 20 miles. So I'm not sure if it's really 20 miles on a side, but however far it is, it's plenty of quail. It's more quail than they can probably handle, and his arm is not waxed short. It's really going to happen. So people rose up all that day and all the night, and the next day they're excited for a while. They gathered some quails, the least of them. Okay, the busybodies got more, but the least of them gathered 10 heaps of quails. They spread them all around for themselves about the camp. So you got this camp literally with piles and piles and piles, heaps and heaps of quails. And while the flesh was yet between their teeth, before it was even chewed, the anger of Yahuwah was kindled against the people, and he smote the people with a very great plague. And the name of that place was called Kibrot Hatta'ava, because there they buried the people that lusted. And from Kibrot Hatta'ava, the people journeyed unto Hazeroth, and they abode there. All right, the last chapter is going to tell a story that is, in fact, a very famous story. Also, another one of those that is, let's just say, subject to multiple sets of interpretation. I'll at least mention a couple of odds and ends there. We got Miriam and Aaron. It says they spoke against Moshe. So brother and sister come to brother Moshe, and they commit the evil tongue. Primarily Miriam, but Aaron certainly echoed some of the sentiments. And why? Well, it says here because he had married a Cushite woman. Now, what are they upset about? And here is where you'll find all kinds of variation. What happened, meanwhile, to Zipporah? Is Zipporah still the wife? Some of the Midrash will say, okay, it's because he's not doing the marital duties to Zipporah. Who's the Cushite woman? She's not named. Cush, of course, is generally thought to be modern-day Ethiopia. There are those that say, oh, well, this is a black woman and they were bigots. I don't quite believe that part. Others will say, oh, it's because Moshe took a second wife. And no, that wouldn't have been all that unusual either. Is that the reason? Is it because maybe he's not doing his marital duties to either of his wives? Honestly, that makes a little bit more sense because of what we're going to see in the rest of the story. But the truth is, it's not 100% obvious. But it does say he had married a Cushite woman. All right, now they seem to have an additional problem here too, but it looks like there's a relationship. Now this is why I'm going to suggest I kind of have my own favorite interpretation. Your mileage may vary. You don't have to agree with any of this because there is plenty of ambiguity to go around. So they said, look, has Yahuwah only spoken only with Moshe? Hasn't he spoken with us too? Aren't we in fact prophets? Well, Yahuwah did in fact hear this. And we get an aside at this point. Now, this is another one of those places that I like the Hebrew word. The Hebrew word here is anav. The man Moshe was very anav. Anav gets translated into English as meek. Right, the Anav, the meek shall inherit the earth. Moshe was the meekest man on the planet, above all of those upon the face of the earth. I've always thought it was funny. Yes, here's a guy that is supposedly writing this, and he is describing himself as the most humble man on the planet. Not exactly. Well, okay, he probably didn't write it. He actually is transcribing what it is that the Creator wrote. But interestingly, there's another way to look at Anav, too. I have suggested that if you really want to understand, to my mind at least, what this word implies, meek is, it's not a horrible translation. It's just, what is it? Okay, I don't think the man was a mouse, for sure. Obviously, that's not the case. I do like the understanding of teachable, though. One of the things we see in Moshe's life is, this is a guy, when he gets dressed down, he gets it, and he is teachable. That is, I think, an excellent understanding of what it means to be meek, to be teachable, to be able to take a lesson to heart. But whatever it is, Moshe was really good at it. Now, by the way, this is the first use of that word, anav, and the next time we're going to see it is in the book of Job and in Psalms, too. So, well, do the word study, kind of see what you think. But this is a characteristic that certainly is worth having, and Moshe's got it. Then it says the following, and Yahuwah spoke, surprise, he spoke suddenly unto Moshe, and unto Aaron, and unto Miriam. Come on out, get out of the tent, and get over to the tent of meeting. And the three of them came out. Now, here is where I pause and suggest that there is more to the story. Again, this is part of the Midrash. This does make sense. It's not the only interpretation, but it is kind of one of those things that makes sense. And it even explains Moshe's abstinence. If, in fact, they were upset with Moshe because he isn't doing his marital duties, and he has not been, let me say it as kindly as I can, hasn't been satisfying his wives in the way that he was supposed to, the reasoning is because, and we've seen this before, when all of the people of Israel are going to go up, there needs to be this period of abstinence before you go in to see Yahuwah. Maybe it's so your mind is on the task at hand, thinking about what they're supposed to be thinking about. And that is why it is kind of interesting here that verse 4 says, and Yahuwah spoke suddenly unto Moshe. The surprise aspect. As if the two of them, having perhaps engaged in a little bit of conjugal familiarity, weren't quite ready. But Moshe was. At least, again, that's the consistent part. Come on out to the tent of meeting. They came out. And Yahuwah came down in a pillar of cloud, stood at the door of the tent, called to Aaron and Moshe, and they came forth. Are they ready? Are they in a condition, right, of ability to commune with the Most High? Well, that seems to be at least the place of it. Now, the next few verses have to do with this idea of prophecy and whatever it is that Moshe has got that separates him from all of the others, including Miriam and Aaron. Hear now my words, says the Most High. If there be a prophet among you, I, Yahuwah, do make myself known to him, but I do so in a vision. I speak with him in a dream. ain't the way it is with Moshe. He is trusted among all of my house. With him I speak plainly, mouth to mouth, even manifestly. Not in dark speeches, not in dreams or visions. Nope. In the similitude of Yahuwah does he behold. So why is it you folks were not afraid to speak against my servant, against Moshe? And in this sense, this word anah, meek or humble or teachable, kind of almost takes on a new significance. Like there needs to be some teachability here. And surprise, Aaron and Miriam are going to get it. And the anger of Yahuwah was kindled against them, it says, and he departed. He made the point. Were they ready to hear him? Whatever it was that Moshe was ready for, it doesn't sound like they were ready. But they heard. When the cloud was removed from over the tent, behold, Miriam was a metzora. She had zara'at. She was white as snow. Aaron looked upon Miriam, and behold, whoa, look at that. She was a metzorat, it says in the Hebrew. Now, the word leprous, right? Not necessarily a good translation. She had this thing that is a spiritual malady associated with the idea of, in a lot of respects, comes from Miriam in this discussion. Comes from this understanding of the evil tongue, speaking things that she shouldn't have spoken. Aaron says to Moshe, "Oh, my Lord, do not, I pray you, lay all of this sin upon us, for we in fact have done foolishly. We have in fact sinned. Let her not, I pray, be as one dead, of whom the flesh is half consumed, when he comes out of her mother's womb." So Moshe, he hears, and he cries out unto Yahuwah, and he says, "Heal her now." Root word, right? Rapha. "O Elohim, I beseech you." Now, Yahuwah, while he's listening, is not quite ready to make a done deal of all of this. He says, "Look, Moshe, if her father had but spit in her face, shouldn't she at least hide in her shame for 7 days? Let her be shut up outside the camp for a full week, for 7 days. After that, you can bring her in again." So Moshe is going to listen. Aaron and Miriam are certainly listening. Miriam is going to learn the lesson the hard way. She's going to be outside the camp, kind of the preeminent, the first, the prototype of the Metzorim, the Metzorot to come. She's the test case. She was shut up outside the camp for 7 days, and the people didn't journey, though. They hung around up until Moshe and Aaron brought their sister Miriam back in again, and afterward. Now, they're ready. The people journeyed from Hazeroth and pitched in the wilderness of Paran. And that, of course, then takes us to the end of this Torah portion. So, a lot of stuff going on in here. Interesting stuff and several lessons. To a certain extent, it's almost all over the place. So, you look for a consistent pattern and find, I guess if I had to say a single couple word summary of it, it has a whole lot to do with human nature. With things that, the good parts, as they were commanded, so they did. The bad parts, as they whined, so they suffered, and as they, didn't guard their tongue, so they learned a lesson that way as well.